Good afternoon. My name is Bob Einhorn from CSIS, and I'd like to welcome you to this 30th installment of the CSIS Smart Power Speaker Series. The Smart Power Speaker Series is an outgrowth of a CSIS project. The CSIS Commission on Smart Power, which was co-chaired by former Deputy Secretary of State Rich Armitage and Harvard professor Joseph Nye. The Commission on Smart Power sought to provide a positive vision for U.S. foreign policy in response to declining U.S. standing and influence around the world. The Commission report was issued in November 2007, and you can find it on the CSIS website. Today, our subject is reducing the global threat, the global nuclear threat. The Department of Energy, its predecessor organizations, and the weapons laboratories that DOD has overseen have always played a significant role in the prevention of nuclear proliferation. Among other things, they've helped develop verification technologies and systems, analyzed the nuclear programs of other countries. They've provided advice on whether to export particular nuclear technologies to certain countries. They've cooperated with others in the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And they've, not least, they've ensured the effectiveness and reliability of the U.S. nuclear umbrella to reduce incentives for American friends and allies around the world to acquire their own nuclear deterrent capabilities. For decades, DOE largely provided technical support to other U.S. government agencies working in the field of nuclear nonproliferation. But after 9/11, with terrorism, with nuclear terrorism, becoming perhaps our number one national security threat, DOE and its semi-autonomous affiliate, the National Nuclear Security Organization, or NNSA, have moved to center stage in the interagency in the U.S. fight against nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism. Today, they cooperate with Russia to secure its nuclear installations, weapons, and materials against theft or seizure by non-state actors. They work with former weapons scientists there to give them opportunities in the commercial world and reduce their incentives to sell their know-how to individuals or countries of proliferation concern. They provide countries in potential WMD transit areas sensors and other equipment to detect and deter nuclear smuggling. They participate in the development of a new international civil nuclear energy architecture that can reduce incentives for countries around the world to acquire their own sensitive fuel cycle capabilities, enrichment or reprocessing plants. And they develop forensic technologies that can help deter state actors from assisting non-state actors in acquiring and using nuclear weapons. And this list is just a small fraction of what NNSA does in the area of fighting proliferation. Today, DOE's budget for nonproliferation-related programs is much higher than that of either the Defense Department or the State Department. And we're fortunate today to have as our speaker someone who's directly responsible for all of these activities, and that's Tom D'Agostino. Tom is double-hatted as Undersecretary for Nuclear Security at DOE, as well as administrator, that means the number one, at NNSA. Mr. D'Agostino has been in this current job for over a year. Before that, he was the deputy administrator for defense programs at NNSA, and in that capacity was responsible for the stockpile stewardship program. He held a number of senior jobs in NNSA. He joined DOE in the early 1990s. Before that, he served in the nuclear navy as a submariner. Today, Mr. D'Agostino will be discussing the ways NNSA and the international community can meet 21st century nuclear nonproliferation challenges. So over to you, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Make sure this is on. Well, thanks very much. First of all, I appreciate all of you coming well into the day, 2:30 in the afternoon, to listen to me speak. I think I'll talk for about 20 minutes, and I think we'll have plenty of opportunity for questions. I know you might have many questions on your mind. I also thank CSIS for hosting this series. I think it's a great idea. It's very important to talk about these topics. I consider them nonpartisan in nature. They're important for security. This is a nonpartisan topic. I care deeply about our national security, but in these areas, we're really talking about global security because from my standpoint, whether if we have an RDD, I don't care where it is in the world, or an radioactive dirty device or an improvised nuclear device anywhere in the world, that's not good for our financial markets. It's not good for the people locally. It's a problem for the country, and specifically it's a problem for this country. We all understand how tightly wound and tightly integrated our financial markets are, particularly in this day and age. So, again, thanks very much for being here. I appreciate the series. And as the administrator for the National Nuclear Security Administration, I'm charged with leading our dual mission in the NNSA to maintain the safety, reliability, and performance of the United States nuclear weapons stockpile and to reduce the global danger from weapons of mass destruction. I think we're uniquely positioned for the second mission because we've developed the expertise from the first mission. And as at the core of these two distinct and different missions lies one shared objective, and that's upholding the United States national security by promoting responsible nuclear stewardship, both at home and abroad. And it's this nexus, if you will, of both national security interests that I wish to speak to you today. As a nuclear weapons state, reducing the global nuclear threat starts first at home, but also must include international engagement and cooperation. So today I'll briefly discuss, one, the domestic nonproliferation role of the United States, two, the international role of the United States in addressing the global nuclear threat, and three, last but not least, the role of the international community in promoting nuclear nonproliferation. Clearly, the international environment has evolved greatly in the last 50 years, and the threats to U.S. and global security remain very complicated. Despite this fact, the United States has made dramatic progress in drawing down our nuclear stockpile since the end of the Cold War. Rather than an arms race with Russia, today's more complex threat hinges upon the fear of regional races and the use of weapons of mass destruction by non-state actors. And this reality underscores the importance of a national security strategy that relies both on disarmament efforts and nonproliferation efforts to build trust internationally and to prevent the spread of weapons and use of weapons of mass destruction. A principal national security goal of the United States is to deter aggression against ourselves, our allies, and our friends. In this regard, the United States policy is to achieve an effective strategic deterrent at the lowest level of nuclear weapons consistent with our national security needs and our commitments and our obligations to our allies. It's another reality of today's security environment and the highly uncertain future security threat environment that the credible U.S. nuclear capabilities and this security commitment to the allies remains an indispensable part of the deterrence. Given this environment, deterrence is also an important element of our effort to limit proliferation and to prevent nuclear arms races and the nightmare scenario of a WMD use by a terror group. As the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty signatory, the United States also has an obligation towards nuclear disarmament. Balancing both obligations, in 2002, President Bush directed that the United States reduce the number of operationally deployed strategic warheads to 1,700 to 2,200 by 2012. This is consistent with the Moscow Treaty, and President Putin made the same commitment. Beyond that, President Bush declared, because this only addressed the operationally deployed warheads, President Bush declared that the entire U.S. stockpile should be reduced by half from the time he came into the office, and to reach that goal by 2012. Well, in fact, we reached those goals early, 5 years early, reached those goals in 2007. And as a result of that, in December 2007, the President declared a further reduction of close to 15% on top of those numbers by 2012. In all likelihood, we're going to achieve that goal 3 years early and have that done by next year. So I should emphasize that as a result of these types of dramatic, and particularly the last couple of decisions, unilateral actions on the part of the United States, we'll have reduced our stockpile by 85% from the time it was at the end of the Cold War. And that's very significant. But by reducing the stockpile that way, that much, it also adds to warheads that we have in our dismantlement bucket, if you will. These retired warheads don't come apart that easily. Many of them are 40, 50 years old. And many of you can attest that if you've ever worked on an automobile that's very old, that taking it apart is pretty hard, particularly if it's been together for 20, 30 years. So we've been working very hard on our dismantlement effort. And as a result, we've made a considered effort over the last few years to accelerate the rate of dismantlement. And one particular point I bring up is between 2006 and 2007, we increased our dismantlement rate by over 140%, and we're looking to try to match that as we go into 2008 and 2009. 2008, of course, is not over yet, but the results are promising in that area. So that's kind of what we're doing in our own backyard here on nonproliferation to meet our international commitments consistent with the Nonproliferation Treaty. However, a global threat requires a global response. And in keeping with the second NNSA mission that I mentioned earlier, we're working with over 100 countries globally to advance nonproliferation objectives by detecting, by securing, and by eliminating dangerous nuclear and radiological materials. In fact, we've recently re-inventoried and prioritized the known nuclear and radiological sites around the world, and a presidential report that will be issued to Congress this fall outlines the steps the NNSA has taken to collaborate internationally to secure and to account for, to reduce, eliminate, detect, and deter trafficking in nuclear weapons materials and related equipment. To most effectively implement this mission and maximize resources, we focus our efforts on the following principles. One, securing fissile material at its source, also known as our first line of defense, to prevent ready access to this material. Two would be detecting and deterring illicit trafficking as a second line of defense, material that might move between countries, across borders and airports and ports and the like. And three, increasingly focus on the security of civilian, nuclear, and radiological materials. And we recognize the urgency of this mission, and just as we have in our disarmament work and dismantlement of warheads, we've accelerated these nonproliferation efforts as well, particularly in the last 2 to 3 years. Under the Bratislava Nuclear Security Initiative, we accelerated our nuclear security cooperation with Russia and have already completed the security upgrades at 85% of Russian nuclear sites of concern. We're on target to complete the balance of the sites by the end of this year, a commitment that President Bush made and President Putin agreed to a few years back. This year, we've reached a historic nonproliferation milestone by ceasing operation of two reactors located in the city of Svirsk in Russia, ending 43 years of weapons-grade plutonium production there. We anticipate shutting down the one remaining plutonium-producing reactor in Russia no later than 2010. Also, we have verifiably downblended more than 337 metric tons of Russian former weapons-grade highly enriched uranium material, which now provides for 10% of all U.S. electricity, and have reached agreement with Russia on technical and financial plan to eliminate 34 metric tons of their weapons-grade plutonium while at the same time we are also working on our 34 metric tons of weapons-grade plutonium on eliminating that. We recognize, however, that not all of material concern is in Russia or residing at defense facilities. And in response, we have expanded the scope of our international work to new countries and increasingly civilian materials. To support the minimization of civilian use of HEU globally, we are converting research reactors domestically and abroad to low-enriched uranium and repatriating highly enriched uranium back to Russia and the United States. To date, we have converted 52 reactors, 12 of which in 12 of these 52 just in the last 3 years alone, converted them to low-enriched uranium and removed over 1,900 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. We're developing innovative new safeguards technologies and approaches through our Next Generation Safeguards Initiative to ensure that the anticipated growth in the nuclear energy industry worldwide does not contribute to proliferation or outpace international safeguards capabilities. We're also taking aggressive steps to interdict illicit transfers of weapons usable materials and equipment, and to prevent dissemination of related sensitive nuclear technology via strengthened export controls and cooperation. NNSA is on the front line of efforts to help countries meet their safeguard, security, and export obligations under UN Security Council Resolution 1540. In just last year, NNSA trained about 300 nuclear facility operators in foreign countries on material accounting and control procedures, and trained about 1,000 licensing, industry, and customs officers to assess export control license applications and identify strategic commodities. We've been active participants in the Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism, which provides the practical means to achieve the legal mandates of Security Council Resolution 1540. And as an important complement to physical security improvements, the Second Line of Defense program enhances our foreign partners' ability to interdict illicit trafficking in nuclear materials through the deployment of radiation detection systems at high-risk land border crossings, airports, and seaports. To date, NNSA has installed radiation detection equipment at high-volume strategic megaports in 12 countries, and we have work underway in 25 other ports around the world. Now, granted, there are plenty of other ports around the world than just these 12 plus 25. Our total package is to go after 70 of the highest risk areas, and we'll have to go on from there. And as we work to reduce the likelihood of a terrorist acquisition of materials for radiological dispersion devices by detecting, securing, and eliminating vulnerable radiological materials, our Global Threat Reduction Initiative has secured over 655 radiological sites overseas to date, thus protecting over 9 million curies of radioactive materials from theft. The U.S. and NNSA specifically undertake efforts to strengthen the nonproliferation regime and expand international nonproliferation efforts. We continue to provide technical and policy support to U.S. efforts within the nonproliferation regime, including support to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the Nuclear Suppliers Group, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and a wide range of U.S. diplomatic initiatives, including efforts in North Korea. We believe that there are three pillars to effective international nonproliferation engagement and cooperation. The first is maximizing geographical coverage and engagement. I mentioned earlier we're operating in over 100 countries, and I believe we have a trifold in the back that some of you, it looks like some of you have, that provides some detail on the types of work we do in each of those areas. The second pillar, utilizing cost-sharing mechanisms to accelerate existing efforts, pool resources, and help build multinational consensus on nonproliferation goals. And the third, implementing sustainability efforts to ensure that these investments are maintained in the long term. It's not just a matter of putting radiation detectors in and making sure that they can be operated and are consistent with the local sites, but we have to make sure that they stay and they continue to operate, and with our partner countries, that is a key element of that. And as we shift from putting devices out, we need to start shifting more towards sustainability and making sure that there's longevity associated with these. So in keeping with these three principles, we are working to strengthen international collaboration and dialogue on nonproliferation efforts, including developing an international mechanism through which seven countries have pledged over $49 million in contribution to our NNSA nonproliferation programs. NSA is employing these strategies to guide our international work and maximize results. We do this work not only because it's in the U.S. national interest, because it is absolutely vital to international security. Which brings me to the most important point: an effective defense against the spread and use of WMD cannot be unilateral in nature. Let me be clear when I say that I believe the U.S. has a special responsibility in advancing nonproliferation and nuclear security globally, but we should not and we cannot do it alone. Events such as the 9/11 and the revelations of the AQCON network illustrated a bleak fact. Those wishing to do us harm will take every possible, even unforeseen, route to do so. And as the AQCON case proved with respect to WMD, proliferators require only one weak link in the fence to proliferate. In today's global economy and shared security environment, no one country can safeguard against proliferation. Preventing proliferation requires shared strategies, goals, and efforts, and most of all, partnership. Hence, some of the capacity building and cooperative efforts I noted previously. Beyond those efforts, foremost among the urgent nonproliferation goal for the international community is the establishment and the implementation of international nuclear security standards and practices. The anticipated growth of nuclear energy worldwide and the continued pursuit of nuclear weapons by terrorists and states of concern underscore the need for this urgent action. Recognizing the bar set by the amended Convention on Physical Protection of Nuclear Material and UN Security Council Resolution 1540, these standards, international standards, must be both comprehensive and universal enough to serve as an international baseline and guidebook for adequate and effective nuclear security. Just last week, NNSA convened a meeting of nuclear experts from 14 countries, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and other federal agencies to examine the challenges to the safeguard system and to begin to outline an agenda for cooperation to meet anticipated safeguard needs and to prevent proliferation. The United States remains committed to working with our partners and expanding cooperation to establish and to implement a set of international security standards consistent with today's national security realities. Together, we must build a system to exclude the possibility that proliferators would need just one weak link in the system of export controls, safeguards, and physical protection to acquire proliferation-sensitive materials. And we applaud the anticipated launch of next month of a World Institute for Nuclear Security, also known as WINS, that effort to promote the sharing and implementation of nuclear security best practices. The success of our efforts to deny access to nuclear weapons and material is very much dependent on our foreign partners recognizing the threat and joining international efforts to help us all combat it. A country's nuclear security responsibility does not stop at the boundaries of its nuclear facilities, nor at its borders, but rather requires the sharing of best practices and nonproliferation tools. It requires partnership to facilitate these practices in countries worldwide, and it requires vigilant effort to ensure that international institutions and standards keep pace with developments that happen both internationally and with technology. Never before has the global nuclear security challenge been so daunting, but never before has the potential for benefit in international partnership been so great. Since I know we want to get to questions and answers, I'll just take a note that in about a month or so, the President will be issuing a new global nuclear security report to Congress. This is consistent with the requirements of the National Defense Authorization Act, and this report was developed in large measure by the NNSA in concert with our federal agencies, but we'll be pulling together the bulk of that, and it will outline in much greater detail U.S. government efforts to respond to the global nuclear security threat and particularly focus on the material and the contributions of the international community. Thanks very much for your patience and your time. I look forward to addressing your questions.
Thank you very much, Tom. Let me start the questioning off with a question about U.S.-Russian cooperation. NNSA has been involved up to its ears for the last decade or so, working with the Russians, securing their nuclear materials and installations, a whole range of important activities. There seem to me there are two developments. One is that These programs started at a time when Russia was on its back economically, in very bad shape, and really needed the assistance. Now Russia is doing very well economically with the price of oil and natural gas the way they are. My first question has to do with why should the U.S., I'm playing devil's advocate, I have my own answer to this, why should the U.S. continue to fund these programs when Russia is in a position to fund them by itself? Often I hear a debate on this issue. Some people say, let's cut off funding. They have more than enough money to do it on their own. But the other point of view I hear is, if we cut them off, we're not sure they would sustain these programs the way we want them to be sustained. So the first question is the future of this kind of cooperation. But second related matter is the difficulties we're having with the Russians over Georgia. Clearly there's a poisonous new element in our bilateral relationship. How do we prevent the difficulties going on in the overall relationship from impacting what seems to be in the vital national interests of both countries?
Okay, I'll take them both, and they're somewhat related. With respect to your first question, both Russia and the United States recognize that our programs there have evolved. They were first developed in the 90s, as you pointed out. Financial situations were a lot different. But you have to look, our program has evolved, I think, actually, to reflect those changes. As I mentioned earlier, we'll be done with all of the commitments under Bratislava by the end of the year. And we are going to plan, and we've added a few more items with Russia onto that list. But in the end, what we've done is we've shifted the physical security program to focus on sustainment. And we're, in fact, with Russia, are developing cost-shared models. So this isn't just the United States or any particular country. Russia's actually come up to the table and is cost-sharing and protecting and securing their areas. Now, the United States is doing this not just because it feels like it's throwing money over the fence to Russia. On the contrary, this is both in Russia's security interests and our security interests as well. So, in fact, we're doing this for ourselves. We're going to be a little parochial ourselves. But the evolving program, the fact that the program is now shifting from one which was purely paid for and done to one where there's cost sharing, and our shift now is towards sustainability. It's not a matter of, and we have commitments from Russia, and they're following through on just not putting up a fence or putting together a physical security protection measure, but sustaining it over time. I think that addresses your first question. The second question is an important one. We recognize in the NNSA, in fact, both Will Tobey, who's my deputy administrator for nonproliferation, and I have emphasized that these programs should transcend what I would call any particular up and down that might exist on the international front. I think the Russians and the United States both recognize the value of these programs. We have a commitment, this administration, despite the recent activities that have gone on, has a commitment that we're going to follow through on working with Russia in the nonproliferation area. This is just way too important for the world for us to just say we're going to pause that activity. That's a consensus view within this administration, and I'm glad to see it. I think it's the right thing to take, because I think it's right for the country, and it's right for the world, and it's right for Russia. So the relationship that we have with Russia in engaging on these areas, I think, is a bright spot in our relationship with other countries, and should be taken as something that is nonpartisan in nature, something that's important for the world. Both countries recognize that.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to open this up now. Please raise your hand. I'll recognize you. We have people with microphones. Wait for the microphone. Identify yourself and any affiliation you have, and be succinct in asking your question. Right up here in front.
David Kopp with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. This summer, Mr. Tobey testified on Capitol Hill that you guys needed about $300 million in the short term for your North Korean work. Since then, obviously, things have slowed down considerably. But Congress right now is writing probably the last appropriation bill for the year. Do you need that $300 million to go forward with the North Korean work, or are you going to be able to wait until Congress writes your regular bill sometime next spring?
The $300 million that David was referring to was when we move forward and are confident with we have agreement on a verification protocol that we would actively move towards fully dismantling the North Korean program. It's the part that we know about right now. It involves not just defueling the reactor, which is more than halfway done, and taking down the tower, which is already completed, as many of you probably have seen. But it involves actually doing a lot more than that, taking the fuel out of the country and going into other parts of their program. Right now, as you know, we've had some setbacks. We appear to have a disagreement on the verification, because we do want to make sure that we can understand that the program has been is going to stop and is going to continue to stop over time. The $300 million is only needed if we move forward towards the larger dismantlement effort. That message has been communicated to important members on the Hill. They understand that. The people in the administration know it. We do have to wait for Congress to act. But in the meantime, I don't see, if we do get progress on the verification side, I'm confident that this administration will ask for, and Congress will take seriously any request to increase our budget in order to make move things forward. Waiting for continuing resolutions or supplemental appropriations to do this, that's a difficult thing to do. We would probably go forward fairly quickly and ask for more money if we thought we needed it. But right now, we don't see a lot of movement in that direction. But I can assure you that I'm ready to ask for money. We've got our request ready to go if we think it's going to move forward.
From the Congressional Research Service. Mr. Secretary, I'd like to follow up on the question that Bob Arnhand started with, and that is, in recent weeks, has there been any detectable fall off in Russian enthusiasm or Russian commitment to continue with these cooperative programs that you described the U.S. commitment to continuing?
It's a great question. What I can give you, Stuart, maybe is an anecdote, if you will. We, on any given day, we have well over 180 folks, either direct NNSA federal employees or some of our contractors working in Russia with the Russians. If there has been any fall off, we would know about it immediately. And neither Will Tobin nor I have received any calls or any indications that the Russians are any less enthusiastic towards continuing on with this work. I think that's consistent with my experience when I work with the Russians. In this area, they understand the importance, and they're as enthusiastic as wanting to secure material as we are. Something I pointed out to my boss just the other day was that I feel good about this because, in the end, what it comes down to, this is a kind of a contact sport. We have people overseas, Americans overseas, folks will come to the United States. We sit down across the table. We hammer out agreements. The people that are working these programs on a day-to-day basis are doing it because they feel it's important. And that is not just on the United States side. It's on the side of our partnership countries. So at the working level, and from what I can talk about on the U.S. level, on the government, certainly up through me and higher, that enthusiasm continues. And that's a good sign. Thank you. Okay.
Tom Cochran.
Tom Cochran with the Natural Resources Defense Council. The advanced spectroscopic portals do not reliably detect lightly shielded, highly enriched uranium. They're proposing to deploy them only as a backup, which means they won't increase the detection capability whatsoever, but would only reduce false alarms. Is your advice to Homeland Security to deploy these systems or not to deploy them?
It's not as simple as a yes or a no, deploy or not deploy. There's a big difference between, and I understand your point, this isn't just a matter, as I mentioned earlier in my talk, of just putting portal detectors out there and letting them be. They have to be integrated in with the operations. The ASPs take longer in order to do an appropriate count on a device. So what we have is a plan to deploy some at 3 ports overseas and test them out, kind of phase them in as we would do any type of new technology and phase them in appropriately, see how well they work, assess them in an operational environment, and then go from there. Right now, when you say backup, they're really, when we get a detection somewhere, we would use them and take more, pull that cargo off to the side and take a lot more time with these ASPs and probably as well with handhelds, radiacs, in order to look for the material that got the initial hit on the first one.
So if the HEU does not get through the earlier detectors that are deployed, which it can easily do, it will not be detected by the advanced systems, and yet you would still deploy them.
Comment or question? Is that a comment or a question? Okay.
Okay. Yes, right here in front.
I'm Rob Nelson from the Union of Concerned Scientists. You mentioned at the beginning that the administration had completed reduction to roughly half of the total warhead stockpile by last December, and that at the end of next year there'll be another 15% reduction. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more about what you mean by the word reduce.
Sure.
My understanding is that these weapons won't be dismantled for well over a decade because of backlog at Pantex, and that to a large extent they're still at the same storage site, but just with a new label that says they're no longer part of the inactive hedge.
I'll be glad to answer that question. It's a great question. And I've talked about part of that in my talk. We had a lot of warheads in the Cold War, as many of you know. Fortunately, I can't give you the exact numbers classified. And what we've done is we've taken a huge portion of those warheads off. We said we're going to dismantle them. Because this isn't as simple as taking a screwdriver out and taking your wire cutters out and cutting some wires and saying, I'm good. It really involves to dismantle a warhead. You have to separate the high explosives from the special nuclear material. That's the very first and very most important step. Many of these things were not designed with ease of dismantlement in mind, unfortunately. You know, that's just the way it is. Some of them have potting compounds that have been in there for 30, 40 years that are stuck, combined, sticking points together. These are old, some of these are very old and sensitive devices. We don't rush, and by design, we don't rush to say, I got to take these things apart as quickly as I can. There's a balance between safety and speed, and I will always err on the side of safety. At the same time, we have a group called the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board. Some of you may have heard about this group. They provide independent oversight and in essence are an extra set of eyes and ears. And with the Defense Board, we develop a new set of tools, not crescent wrenches or screwdrivers, but special tools that are designed just for that warhead. And as a result of that, we're starting an increase in rate. So what we don't want to do is hire up 1,000 production technicians at Pantex, spend a lot of money training them up just so we can say we can take apart these weapons in 2 or 3 years. And quite honestly, we can't do that safely. So what we've done is we've put together a separate dismantlement line at Pantex, developed these procedures, and taken a step, and we were actually on a path. Actually, the problem was a little bit worse than you said. At our previous rate, early on in the Bush administration, we weren't going to get that last warhead taken apart until 2034. We moved that date up to 2023 as a result of some of the changes a few years ago, despite the fact that we added more weapons to that dismantlement queue. So we're taking apart, and I can't give you the number, but it's multiple hundreds over a period of time, over years, taking apart those warheads every year. And one final point I want to make, I think this is important, is sometimes I get fixated on, well, how many did we take apart this year? Are we on track? One warhead is not the same as another one. The W-79, for example, was an artillery shell, very compact and very small, extremely complicated and been together for a long time. That is a lot. That's a very hard system to take apart. The B-53 is a very old bomb that we have in our dismantlement queue. That was designed back in the 50s and is a very sensitive device. So one B-53 is not equal to a 79 or a 78. So, you know, I've tried to describe this in how many tons of megatons of bombs I've taken apart, how many numbers of bombs, how many man-hour or equivalent. I've done it in equivalent units. And the reality is you can do it any number of those ways. But the primary objective for me is to do it as safely as possible. Final point on your comment on where they're stored, I think is one of your points. These warheads are stored in various sites around the country, but we're pulling them into Pantex because that's the place, and we've moved a tremendous amount into our place where we ultimately do our disassembly, and then we ship the secondaries off to Y-12 to the secondary disassembly. So there's been pretty much a sea change in how and where these things are stored. But the items on the list, it's a report we provide that the President provides to Congress. They get the list of warheads by year, by type, which ones were taken apart, and I have a requirement to provide Congress a classified report every year. So there are a lot of people looking to make sure we're doing what we said. I feel confident that we're on the right track.
Yes, the gentleman over here.
I'm Stanley Falk, and I'm just wondering if you could comment on the impact on non-proliferation of the proposed nuclear treaty with India.
Certainly. I feel that the treaty with India, this is actually up in Congress right now, the 123. I think most of you know that. It's important, from my view, that we engage India in this area. And I think, you know, there'll be many that argue that this is a bad thing for non-proliferation. I would argue that it's a good thing, mainly on the basis of our ability to engage directly with India and making sure that whatever they do is much more transparent to the international community, with the concessions on bringing the IAEA in there to inspect their facilities. I think ultimately that's the right thing to do. What we don't want to do, I mean, India's security is important to the world, I would argue, and I would argue that what we want India to do is if they go forward in developing their nuclear industry, that they do so with, you know, the advanced or next generation safeguards in mind. In fact, that was one of the reasons why we had this meeting last week, was to make sure that as the nuclear industry goes off and develops its designs for future civil power production, that we want safeguards designed into the systems versus having them have to be inspected in by more, ultimately, inspectors. Because the IAEA is going to face tremendous pressure over the next years, which the global community has to support. But the better thing to do, actually, is design in the safeguards from a technical standpoint. So
verification is the key.
Absolutely. Being able to engage in verification with India, that's right.
I'm going to bite my tongue on that one and play a neutral host.
Okay. Thank you,
Laura.
Laura Holgate from the Nuclear Threat Initiative. I was pleased with all the progress and to hear your report on the progress on repatriation and returning of U.S. Materials, dangerous materials, to the U.S. I'm curious to know what progress you're making, if any, to expanding the proportion of that material, of that we send out, compared with what's eligible to be brought back. I understand there's a need to create more legal space and more financial space for that material, because well less than half of it is eligible for return to the U.S., which means it'll remain stranded overseas. Curious, yeah. what progress towards expanding that.
You're talking about some policy implications about the ability to bring material back into this country, which didn't originate necessarily here?
Well, that would be an ideal goal, but I'm talking about U.S. origin material that was sent out but is not eligible for return to the U.S.
Will Toby's got a list of those that he told me he's working on policy initiatives to put that forward. I don't have the details, Laura, right now to be able to answer that specifically, but I can get that to you, or I can provide it to Bob and we can post it on the website. Maybe one way to do it.
Great. Yes, you've had your hand up for a while on the aisle.
Yes, Christopher Payne with NRDC. On the question of the MOX plant at Savannah River Site, two questions. I understood the funding for that has been transferred to NE, which is not mentioned in the fact sheet. Is this program returning to your shop, to your agency, or is it now going to be permanently administered by NE? And second of all, the plant is going forward without the necessary precursor, which is the plant to provide the feedstock, the pit disassembly and conversion facility. And why does that make sense?
Okay.
And when would we expect the pit conversion and facility to be available?
Let me start with your second question first. On pit disassembly and conversion, or PDCF, is our program of record. It's our plan right now. We are currently doing the design phase with the idea of early next year doing what's known as a critical decision 2, CD2, which is where we say we have enough information about the design that we can put together a validated cost, schedule, and scope of the project. It's starting after MOX, as you correctly point out, and there will be a gap between the completion of the pit disassembly and conversion facility finish and the start of MOX. So what we're doing now is we've undertaken, call it a gap analysis, if you will, of how do we make sure that there's enough oxide material to make sure that the gap period gets covered effectively. And there are a couple of options on that. We're looking at a number of options to include. There's an Aries line, which is this advanced recycle line up at Los Alamos, which is actually testing out the PDCF processes. It's so part of our important project that can make a certain amount of material per year. So we're thinking about starting up that line early to make sure we build up material so that when MOX comes online, it has material ready to go. We absolutely agree with you. It doesn't make any sense to not have the oxide in ready to go as soon as the MOX plant gets done. And that is not in our plans. So PDCF is on track. It's on our schedule. It's consistent with the plan that we've laid out. We just want to make sure that gap gets covered as schedule changes. You know, and this gap changes a little bit based on congressional appropriation. And you pointed out your first question. We have taken an over $200 million hit in the MOX project as a result of a number of actions by Congress over the years. And these are very complicated projects to manage. So once we've established a baseline schedule and scope, we like to lock in that date because it impacts other projects, and PDCF is a case in point. We're in the process of negotiating a plutonium management disposition agreement with Russia. We've put forth a proposal with the Russians. We're waiting for their comments back, and we'll go back and forth until we get agreement on how that works. But we do have the letter from last year, I think you're probably familiar with, on that. So it is in negotiation with Russia. Your first question, I think, I want to make sure I get to that, which was funding of the project. The Congressional House Energy and Water Subcommittee, which provides the appropriation, wants this project funded out of the nuclear energy program. We've put forth a legal piece that raises some concerns on how we can do this legally. We want to comply with congressional intent here. And right now, we're going to be, and we're working, in fact, ultimately this is what it's going to take, is getting back to the Energy and Water Subcommittee to make sure it gets done. In the meantime, we all agree it's a DOE project. The team is together working on it. In my view of whether it happens in NE or NNSA, is secondary to the more important question is that it happens, and it happens successfully. Clearly changing funding sources and streams and management teams halfway through is usually typically not good for large, complicated projects. This is no exception.
Thank you. Up here in front.
Thank you. I'm Leonard Oberlander. Across the board in including the treaties, and physical security and physical barriers to theft of nuclear weapons and proliferation. Could you say something about issues of standards, perhaps technical standards, physical standards, and standards of cooperation that are problematic and that need to be dealt with? And also, is there an element, it hasn't been mentioned at all, besides physical deterrence, of psychological deterrence methods incorporated in this?
Okay. Well, that second part's probably a little bit out of my lane, but what I can say, let me go to the first one on standards, because that's very much a difficult area. Standards are very important, whether we're talking about a graded safeguards table on how much security one we should consistently apply around the world, start with the United States first, but then each country has their own. So we're already dealing with people that have countries that have their own views on how they protect different quantities of what types of materials. So normalizing those and making sure we don't open some gaps in there is very important. And we're working very hard on a graded safeguards table to make sure that that happens kind of internationally. We clearly have one in the United States. It's a classified table because if you read it, you can back away from that and figure out how much quantity of what type of material you would need in order to make a nuclear device. Certainly, we don't want to add to the internet situation at all, so we're going to keep away from that. But the standards on how we do that is very important. This WINS effort, or this World Institute for Nuclear Security, I think it's a great way to address this kind of in an unclassified way, kind of on the physical protection side, by providing a forum for countries to share best practices on how they do nuclear security. We will be an active player and participant in that. I think it's a great initiative by the NTI that putting that forward, and we applaud that. In fact, I talked to my chief of defense nuclear security today, told him, I want to make sure you're aware of this thing, because when this thing comes online, I think it's within a month or so, that we're going to be active players on this. On your second, psychological deterrence, is that what you're... can I take a pass on that? I think I'd like to. There are other agencies that probably get involved in that. I try to be as upfront as I can, because that's good for partnerships.
I'm going to jump the queue again for a question on the reliable replacement warhead, which you've been, fully involved in. This project, at least in the last few Congresses, has not done very well.
Right.
I put that delicately. I've read in the last week or so reports, don't know if they're accurate or not, alleging that Stratcom has developed its own thinking about this question, and in fact has gotten to the position where it would really prefer to rely on life extension programs and build into those life extension programs some of the improvements that would have gone into the RRW. Are those accurate reports? And whether or not they're accurate reports, does this concept make sense?
Well, I won't I've learned in public forum before that you don't speak for somebody else. So, but what I do talk to General Chilton quite a bit. He and I are both on the Nuclear Weapons Council, and we talk about how do we make sure that the future stockpile, however small it is, however big it is, whatever composition it is, has the most advanced safety and security features built into those warheads. As you know, or as it maybe if you've heard me say it, and as I've testified, the best way in my view to do this is to design them in up front. Kind of similar to the question of reactor technology. If you're going to design the next generation reactors, you want to make sure that you design in proliferation features that we may not have been thinking about actively in the 60s and 70s when these reactors were first designed. Similar to the warhead question. Since we haven't convinced Congress that we would like to not build but just study This is all we're trying to do. Whether this concept makes sense, we haven't been successful there. We've decided, what is the next best thing to do? And the next best thing to do, in my view, and now this is me talking, is to look at how we can take some of those features that made sense and build them in. I can tell you, and I can't be specific, but in unclassified area, but what I can say is there are some things we can do and there are some things we can't do. And it's those things that we can't backfit into our existing stockpile that worry me, because those are the real game changers. Those make a nuclear weapon about as lethal as this table up in here in front of us. The only damage you do is if you trip over it or if it drops on your head, but it won't go off. I'd rather have a weapon that looks like this coffee table. But at any rate, bottom line is, I think what we're looking at is how much can we do with our existing stockpile? Congress has asked us to look at that, and we're going to actively look at that as we shrink our stockpile.
Thank you. Yes, in the back there. Oh, Dan Horner.
Hi, Dan Horner from Platts. I had a couple questions about the Russian programs. One, on the plutonium disposition that was mentioned earlier, you said you were negotiating with the Russians now on that, but you had an agreement back in November on how to go forward on that. And my understanding at the time was essentially mechanics about how to revise the earlier agreement. So what is it you're negotiating, and are there holdups in there? If you can just talk about that. And also I was going to ask about if you're pursuing any steps with the Russians about further blend down of high-enriched uranium after the current agreement expires in 2013, and in particular if that's affected by the recent downturn in relations, that would seem to be one area that might be directly affected. Thanks.
Okay. It's my understanding. I mean, I don't believe the recent change in the relationship, at least what you read in the papers, that has affected the Russian HEU agreement at all. So that's going well, or potential follow-on negotiations on that, which I think was the original part of your question. Trying to think of how to approach your other question. You're essentially were concerned about PMD, the Plutonium Management and Disposition Agreement. Last year, Secretary Bodman and Mr. Kerienko signed a letter which says this is how we are going to go forward together on disposing of our 34 tons. What we want to do is actually document that in an actual Plutonium Management Disposition Agreement. In other words, change the previous agreement from years earlier. So it's really more of a matter of quantifying within a specific agreement, not a letter, to move forward in this area. We're not waiting for that. We think the MOX program is important. We want to get rid of 34 tons. In fact, last year, the secretary, and I looked at the stockpile of plutonium that we maintain in this country. I talked to the secretary about it. We worked it through the administration to declare an additional 9 metric tons on top of that as excess to national security needs. That is something we continue to evaluate on whether we can add to that. We're not going to wait for Russia to, we're not going to do a quid pro quo on whether we ought to each make sure we're only adding the exact same amount. We think it's important to us to extract the energy value of that material as well as get that material essentially off the street. Not off the street, but essentially get it, make it no longer plutonium. That could be dangerous.
Okay. Ted Turner from NTI, I'm sure Ted was happy to hear you talk about winds the way you did, Tom.
Okay.
I'm not here as a representative of NTI. I'm just here. I got an invitation. I'm sure you're familiar with the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Sam Nunn, and Bill Perry calling for the total nuclear disarmament. Also, Gorbachev wrote a similar letter a couple of weeks later that also appeared in the journal. And one of the presidential candidates has said that he will work, if he's elected, for total nuclear disarmament. Has this gotten into your department? Is there discussion, and is there any hope for some movement in that direction?
Okay, great question. And The letter has indeed. I read the very first article probably the day after it came out, along with everybody else, and the second one a year later. Since then, I've had a chance to personally talk, particularly to George Shultz and Bill Perry, about this and where we're going forward. Because, I mean, I think it's important that in my responsibilities, that I understand their intention in this area. I don't speak for the four that wrote the article, but my impression after talking with Mr. Perry and Mr. Shultz was not exactly running immediately to total disarmament. It's doing it, obviously, getting there, consistent with the treaty obligations, but doing it in a way that makes sure what we don't do is create another imbalance in another area. And I think the actions by the United States over the last few years demonstrate that we're heading in that direction. All the vectors are heading in the right direction. We're reducing the size of our stockpile. We've accelerated our dismantlements. Granted, it's going to take a few years, Rob, I think, you know, to get done, but we want to do it safely. We want to eliminate building up of stocks by proposing the fissile material cutoff treaty so we don't add to this question of warheads. And I want to be successful in hitting the president's goals that were these 2012 goals now that we're going to move them up to 2009 and doing it in a safe way. I think where the stockpile size goes after we get to the 1,700 or 2,200 number, I know is something that I'll be talking to the Bipartisan Commission on Strategic Review that is happening. I'm scheduled to see them a week from Monday at Lawrence Livermore, and we're going to talk about exactly those types of issues. And they're clearly going to independently come to their views and on where they need to go. I can assure you, though, that those articles have had an impact on the way we think. We want to do it in a way that doesn't create imbalances in other areas. I think making a declaration that we're going to go to zero and we'd like the rest of the world to follow and doing that right now, my own view now is that I mean, I can't disinvent plutonium and uranium, but what I can do is control the programs that I have right now. And I think maintaining a strategic balance and having the whole world go consistently in that direction is important. And what we see right now internationally with other countries, as I get intelligence reports, is that there are things happening around the world that are not consistent with that article. And we all have to kind of agree that that's the way we want to go forward in order to do it in the right way. But it has had an impact.
Yes.
My name is Yonghan Keo, currently at Georgetown University as a visiting scholar. Now, as I understand it, the Bush failure to delisting North Korea from the terrorist-sponsored country led to North Korea kind of suspending its disablement process. So my question to you is, what is your assessment of the six-party talks approach to disarming North Korea nuclear program? Is it too idealistic, or what is the difference between disablement and dismantling and also disarming? I'd like you to share your perspective on those complex issues.
Thank you, sir. I'll probably go with the last question first. Disable, in our view, means taking actions that prevent kind of like the immediate restart, if you will, of the production complex. And in this specific case for North Korea, we're talking about the plutonium reactor and the plutonium reactor production. And clearly there's been a disablement activity. We're defueling the reactor. Dismantlement takes it really quite honestly to the next level, because the original intent of the talks were to essentially make sure that there is no program, essentially, in North Korea, but at the same time ensure that North Korea gets what it needs in order to move forward and join the international community. I don't think the six-party talks are too idealistic. I think they need to continue. I think we need to keep talking. The most important thing is to not get ourselves into where we throw ourselves rhetorically across and use the media essentially as a mechanism for discussion. It has to be sit down face to face. Chris Hill, of course, is spending a lot of time in aircraft going back and forth. I'm with him on that. We have people in the NNSA that are supporting that group, our technical experts that are there. So I want to see it continue. I want to see the dialogue continue. I'd like to move forward. The hang-up is this question of, you know, how do we adequately verify that we're all on the same page on this? In my simplistic view, we ought to be able to solve that problem. But it's not going to get solved. It's got to get solved face-to-face and with a group. I'm not a foreign diplomat. I'm not a diplomat. I haven't been through State Department training. But my sense is it's important that this not just be a United States kind of unilateral action. I like the idea of engaging and having the international community as part of this, because that's the way we're ultimately going to have to address with even a broader set of nuclear security issues that are going to come up as the nuclear power industry kind of steps up its pace.
John?
John Wolfstall here at CSIS. I was at Department of Energy when NNSA was created, largely out of concerns over the Department of Energy's security mechanism over both classified material and physical protection. In the last year, we've discovered that there are larger problems within the U.S. nuclear weapons complex. I'm wondering, since the joyride of six nuclear weapons in the Air Force took place, what specific steps have taken place within NNSA to reassess not just the paper guidelines for how security should be implemented, but whether the personnel are actually following through on those guidelines, and to what sense you have had to synchronize your activities with what's going on with the Schlesinger Commission?
Sure. Great question, John. I can assure you that we, outside of the incidents that have happened in the Air Force, completely outside and stuff we're continuing to do now, we have an independent assessment branch of the Department of Energy, not tied to the NNSA at all, that aggressively goes after our sites, and we do force-on-force exercises. We check out our security protocols, how well the paperwork is being maintained, whether our material protection control and accountability systems are right, and the like, including cybersecurity in that, which is actually, we spending a lot of time on physical security, and that's important, but we also want to make sure that the information that we have is adequately protected, and that's a hard job. Since I'm on the Nuclear Weapons Council, and since I'm obviously I spent a lot of time with the folks in the Air Force in understanding how the problem happened, Admiral Donald, who led the report on that, obviously is part of the NNSA, so we were involved quite a bit right up front, and he and I went over the findings, and my first thought in my mind was exactly where you were, is what are we learning here, and how can I apply that back to the NNSA? And to answer that question, I took my former chief of defense nuclear security, Bill Desmond, pulled him out of his job and said, full time, your job is to take the lessons learned from the Air Force report, the Kirk Donald report, and the Schlesinger report, and see, first of all, how well we're doing and whether they can be applied to the NNSA, and are we doing the right kind of job? I'm expecting that report in October. We're going to take it up to the secretary to make sure that I have kind of an independent group. And he's got people from the outside doing that, including from support from naval reactors. So I feel very confident that our systems are working well from a physical security side, or at least I know the current status. What I want to make sure is this whole question of how the logistics chain works its way through is well taken care of. And I'll, you know, I'm comfortable with it now, but I'm getting an independent check of it.
Yeah, in the back.
Hugh Gustafson, George Mason University. Morale among weapon scientists at your labs at Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore is at an all-time low. The weapon scientists are deeply unhappy with the new management structure. They would much prefer to be back under the University of California. And at Lawrence Livermore, where there's a massive riff underway, even scientists who are not being riffed are looking for other jobs because they're afraid they'll be next. What plans do you have to improve the situation at the labs?
Okay. A couple of points I want to clarify, maybe your question, if I could. There's currently not a reduction in force underway at Lawrence Livermore. Now that's, we had a reduction in force earlier with the contract change. The morale concerns that you've talked about are driven probably by a couple of things. One is contract competition that the department has undertaken. We undertook the contract competition specifically. There was direct congressional action written into law that required us to push this and make sure that we have a full and open competition. We did that for Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos. Those are completed. So many of the changes, concerns you talked about reflect changes that have happened over the last 2 years. The morale concern, and I'm deeply aware of it, has to do, and this is something that is probably my number one problem, I mean, aside from what we talked about, but something that I've pushed to have an impact on, and that is critical skills. This country needs the best scientists and engineers it can get. And those scientists and engineers, the best ones, have options. And so when they look at what gets appropriated and authorized, and they, trust me, they read the authorization and they read particularly the appropriations report language, and they get a sense of how we feel in either in Congress. I'm not in Congress, but I'm always very supportive of that. And I've had issues lately getting financial support and making sure that that happens. So when budgets go down, I can't pay people out of promises. We have to do reductions. The main concern I have is that the reason why I think we're doing, and I believe we're doing a good job in nuclear counterterrorism, nonproliferation, and intelligence analysis of what's going on around the world is because we've been riding on the back, essentially, of multiple decades worth of support to our weapons laboratories, our nuclear laboratories. And these critical skills will go away as the budgets go down. But these are capabilities that we're going to need regardless of the size of our stockpile. You know, unless we disinvent uranium and plutonium, I still think the country is going to be interested in having the best folks available to disarm an improvised nuclear device or an RDD. And in fact, when we have our render safe teams, that's what we call them, render safe, that support the United States and actively go out there and support the FBI on, say, which wire to cut, those are folks that have had experience in designing warheads. They come from our national laboratories. So, you know, in a few years, if we're not careful, we're going to lose those critical skills. And my job is to keep them in place. The last part of your question is, what am I doing about it? That's a great point. I've talked to the secretary, and I've worked with our lab directors, and we've laid out a sea change for the nuclear weapons complex. You know, my vision and the vision of the lab directors and the secretary is to shift from a Cold War nuclear weapons complex, which, and everything that implies, large size, not designed with environmental factors in mind, material everywhere, to a 21st century national security enterprise. It's an enterprise that's focused not just on the offensive part of the game, i.e. the warhead part, but on the defensive part of the game, i.e. the counterterrorism, the nonproliferation part, and recognizing that those skills and capabilities not just support the Department of Energy and its work for the DOD, but are also important to the FBI and other security agencies. So the Secretary signed out a lab vision statement a few months back, and I can provide that to you, Bob, if you'd like. I'd love to get that out. I've talked to members of Congress about it, and it's a statement that will involve real, it's not just good enough to put out a vision. You've got to follow it up with real action. And that vision basically talks about, one of the action steps that we're putting through in this year is to get commitment from other federal agencies that are riding on the back of the NNSA to commit to investing in the infrastructure. And I believe we're going to get an agreement signed by a federal agency. I won't say who. I'll make sure it comes out for a multi-year commitment to invest in this infrastructure that's so important to nuclear counterterrorism and nonproliferation. And that's what I want. I don't want to lose on that part of the equation just because we've gone through a dip in support on the Hill.
Okay.
Great question.
Just a couple more questions. Yes. Yeah.
Myhill from Business Executives for National Security. I had a quick question about the cyber threat issue. It seems like a lot of organizations are working on it, and it seems to be very decentralized. I know the SS, the Secret Service, and the DHS, and the FBI are all working on the cyber threat. I was wondering if there were efforts to streamline and to avoid duplication and gaps in information, and I don't know if you can answer that.
Sure. I'll answer what I can. Some of it I can't answer in this forum, but every agency is concerned about the cyber threat, and we're all undertaking efforts uniquely to make sure that they at least have what I would call, they've got their standards up to a certain point. You know, the right kind of tools and monitoring systems in place specifically, and an active group of people that are all constantly looking at the networks to look for intrusions and the like. Now, obviously, in the NNSA, for example, we basically have two main networks. We have a red network, which is a classified network, and a yellow network. Call it yellow. It's not green because there's PII or personally identifiable information on it, you know, social security numbers. It's you know, human resources type of information that we don't want out there. And our red network is fenced off and walled off, air-gapped and the like, still being monitored. And our yellow networks are the ones that we're most concerned about because those are the ones that get attacked thousands of times a day. In the DOE, I'll give you an example of what DOE is doing, and then I'll try to address it more broadly because I think your main question was the interagency. In the DOE, we've essentially consolidated the cybersecurity review groups. We had three or four areas around the country that were looking at networks, and we've essentially, and the NNSA is providing this support to the rest of the department, we've consolidated it down into one area geographically where communication hubs tend to centralize, and these are people that are looking actively at what is happening across the whole DOE complex, not to include the NNSA. So we have centralized within the DOE. We've held a couple of classified cybersecurity summits. Clay Sell started this off last year as the deputy secretary. We've continued that this year, where we look at making sure we know what the threat is and what tools are available to do it. Now, there is a national effort underway to look at reducing the number of open ports into the federal government system. There's a natural tension between doing science correctly, more broadly, because you do need to engage the international community and security. And we're wrestling with making sure that that balance and tension is appropriate. It's not easy. It's not easy to do. A final point is we do work for other federal agencies, three- and four-letter agencies, and we test out their systems. They test out our systems. So what appears, I'm sure it appears disjointed, and I know it can probably be improved, but there is an active interagency effort underway to look at how do we get the best ideas to the up to the top and to the fro. Stay tuned. This changes all the time. I mean, this is not going to go away. We'll never reach a point, in my view, where we're perfectly comfortable and say, we got this problem solved. It's not a matter of putting more guards up or putting another layer of fences up to this problem. This problem is very dynamic, and it's fortunately very, very much more dynamic than the federal budget system, which can take a year and a half to go through. By that time, that thing's gone through three or four generations. So there could be a hearing next week on this topic, as I understand.
Okay, we're just about finished. I'm going to call on two, three people and let them go, and then you can just, you know, answer what you want to answer and wrap up.
Let them go.
What do you want? Okay.
Oh, let everybody
go. You've been patient. You, Miles, where are you? Yeah. I'm sorry for the others. Let's take three questions, and then Tom will answer all of them.
If I can remember them all.
Please be. You've got to be really concise.
Stephen Young with UCS, Eastern Scientists. Two very quick questions. One is timeline.
No, you get one question. One question.
There are three unanswered questions. Timeline for the complex transformation PIS and timeline for the unclassified version of the nuclear policy statement from the Secretary of Energy, Secretary of Defense. We discussed this 2 months ago. The unclassified version of the nuclear...
The unclassified version. I'm sorry. Right. I didn't hear that. Okay. Got it?
Nick Roth, Nick Roth, Alliance for Nuclear Accountability. I was at an NNSA presentation at Y12 recently, and among the current activities being underway at Y12 was complex transformation. And I was curious as to why, or it was support of complex transformation. What specifically is being supported at Y12 or within the nuclear weapons complex for complex transformation, and why is it being supported before the EIS process has been completed?
Miles Pomper, Arms Control Today. Mr. Toby talked earlier this year about what would happen if the Supreme Court later this year allowed the ruled in the Urodiv case in a way that affected the HEU agreement with Russia, basically ending the suspension agreement as a legal tool to limit Russian uranium exports to the United States, and said that Congress should do something to make sure that there are limits on this and to provide the opportunity for a follow-on negotiation. Nothing's happened to date. What are you doing in the closing days of Congress to see if what can be done about preventing these limits of the suspension agreement from remaining in place, and what will you do if the Supreme Court upholds the judgment of the lower courts?
Okay. Timelines on complex. There you are. Sorry. We're still on our track very shortly to announce the supplemental programmatic EIS, get it out to the public for, I think there's a 30 or a 60-day period of time. I think it's 30 days, actually, for input, get it out in the public. That doesn't mean a record of decision will be made. That just gets it out in the public. I think that's very important. I think there's for people to understand, just because we put out our final supplemental programmatic impact statement, which goes through the analysis, kind of related to your question, the key ultimately is getting records of decisions. In all likelihood, those decisions will come in appropriate slices, consistent with the analysis. Is the analysis ready to support a decision or not? And that's really important for me, because this is not about rushing a decision because I'm the current administrator and I got to get something done by January the 20th and nothing's going to happen. You know, I'm more interested, I think many of you know, I came up through the ranks, if you will. I'm more interested in making sure we make the right decision at the right time than making sure that we make a decision that has to get done before a certain date. Okay. So you had another question. Unclassified version of the white paper. I talked the last time, it may have been when I testified in July. I don't know if that's what you were referring to, but I expected to get the unclassified version of the more classified white paper out relatively soon. I was optimistic about the interagency process. Two of the three major agencies have approved it. We're waiting on the third one. The third one's pretty busy with Russia, with the Georgia activities, and I'm trying to get this on the top burner, because I think it's important to have this out into the public as the Congressional Bipartisan Commission is going through its deliberations. And my view is getting that information out provides opportunities for the public, NGOs, if you will, and others, to give them an opportunity to provide comment. And you know, each day that goes by is a day that makes it a little bit harder to do that. So you can count on the fact that I'm pushing this one pretty hard, but I've got kind of taken over by world events on that one. Y-12, what is happening? Plans at Y-12 and the preferred alternative at Y-12 is to move out of 100, is to reduce our security footprint from 150 acres down to 15 acres, thus saving many tens of millions of dollars of security costs and also making it more secure at the same time. So it's kind of got a double benefit. What we're doing right now, you were concerned about, we're taking action before the EIS, the Record of Decision, is approved. Part of that plan of going from this 150 acres down to 15 acres is whether we continue to do uranium work in the Y-12 Valley. For the time being, we're going to continue to do work in the Y-12 Valley because we haven't made a decision saying we're not going to do that and we're going to do it some other part of the country. So what we don't take action on with respect before a decision gets made is actually pouring concrete or actually beginning construction of a facility. Now, what we do take action on is design work, because design work informs cost and cost informs decision. So the idea is we want to advance the ball on all the design work or study activity that we need to do, because that helps inform the decision. So we're not going to be building any 9212 or uranium processing facility follow-on until the record of decision gets made and has gone through the appropriate public process. Is that that? Oh yeah, that'll probably catch me on the way out. Not sure exactly what time it is. On Eurodiff, I don't have a good answer for you. I'm not personally taking specific action on that. I believe my deputy administrator is. Like Laura's question earlier, if I can get that done and get it posted on the website, I think it might be the best way to answer that question, to give you a complete and accurate picture on what's going on with the suspension agreement.
I apologize to all those we couldn't get to. I saw your hands, but we just didn't have time. If an indicator of a successful speaker is someone who leaves a lot of people out there still itching to ask questions, this was a very successful, then please help me join me in thanking Tom Agostino. Thank you.
Appreciate it.